Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The latest and best overview of climate feedbacks is out. UK scientist Tim Lenton reports possible futures. From New York, author and activist Andrew Boyd on his new book, I Want a Better Catastrophe. Radio EcoShock starts right now.
China and India are increasing coal burning. Oil and gas companies never made so much money. We know what is going to happen, except we don't. Even with stunning climate science, global models, and the summary reports, we could be flying blind into unexpected catastrophes. A group of leading scientists say many risky feedback loops amplify the need for climate action. They have a list of 60 forces, physical, biologic, and human, all bouncing into our times, feeding back into a destabilized climate. Here to explain is one of our favorite British scientists, Professor Tim Lenton, Director of Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. Tim is a co-author of the new paper, along with Bill Ripple from Oregon, and two of my heroes, Johan Rockström of the Stockholm Resilience Center, and Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, founding director of the Potsdam Institute. These are senior climate scientists, and they are worried. From the UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Is it true, Tim? Are you and your co-authors worried about the known unknowns of climate change?
I'm afraid we are. Yes, we're in this particular study, we're just cataloguing and highlighting the feedback loops that can amplify climate change and noting that we still need to do better at studying and quantifying those, because they can act together to make that climate change considerably worse.
Could you remind our listeners of what a climate feedback loop is and maybe give us an example?
Yeah, so a climate feedback loop is when an initial change in the climate, like some amount of warming, triggers a response from within the climate system that either adds to the warming or counteracts it. If it adds to the warming, we call it a reinforcing or amplifying feedback loop. If it counteracts the warming, we would call it a damping feedback loop or a balancing feedback loop. And we have to worry about how strong, in particular, the amplifying feedback loops. So how much of an extra change you get from the feedback. And there are several of those amplifying feedback loops, and an example would be one we refer to as the ice albedo feedback, which is a fancy scientific way of talking about how if you replace a highly reflective surface of ice, like sea ice on the ocean in the Arctic, with a darker ocean surface, if you melt the ice away, then that darker ocean surface absorbs way more sunlight, over the sunlight basically that the ice would have been reflecting. That heats things up further and tends to melt more sea ice, which exposes even more dark ocean surface, which absorbs more heat and melts more sea ice and so on. And that one's a pretty strong reinforcing feedback.
You and your co-authors have been studying feedbacks and tipping points for years. Why bring out this new big list?
It felt like we ought to look again and update the list of feedback loops, because the last time it had really been thoroughly catalogued that I can remember was probably in a paper I read from back in the 1990s. So it seemed useful just to review where our understanding was at and how long the list was, how many reinforcing feedback loops there are on there compared to the balancing feedback loops, and then think about, you know, how well are we modelling or representing these feedback loops in our efforts to model climate change. Because crucially, if we're missing some reinforcing loops, the reinforcing loops kind of amplify each other. So the more you have of them, the stronger the overall response.
Yes, that's one of the keys to this new paper. And you break things down into what I would call physical feedback mechanisms, and then biological mechanisms, and then human mechanisms. So it becomes quite a list. I thought the role of biological life changing climate has been mainly left out by a lot of science, but not at all in this paper. You add 21 feedback mechanisms possible from the reactions of plants and animals to changing conditions. Are these biological feedbacks minor compared to the big physical systems like ocean currents or sea ice decline?
It depends is the kind of short answer, but some of them are quite significant. In fact, there's really important damping feedback that's coming, especially from the land biosphere and ecosystems. And we talk about that, at least scientifically, as what we call the land carbon sink. But it's the observation that of all of the greenhouse gas, mostly carbon dioxide, we humans put in the air each year, the land takes up more than a quarter, maybe sometimes a third of that. And that's a crucial damping feedback that's been slowing down, if you like, climate change. But there are equally a number of reinforcing feedbacks from the biosphere. And in fact, that one, the land carbon sink, there's a risk that different parts of the land surface can be tipped from a land carbon sink to a land carbon source due to the detrimental impacts of climate change on the biosphere, which could be things like droughts, impacting plant productivity and fires, destroying forests and so on.
I was hoping to see more in the paper about the biological drivers, plankton and bacteria. You have one note about plankton and say it's uncertain, and microbiological activity is listed as positive, raising emissions of other greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide. But still, we don't know much about the world's largest mass of living matter, microscopic life, and we don't know how it will react to warming. Would you agree?
Well, we know something about it, but we need to know more. So characteristically, when you warm things up, microbes generally like that, and they do their metabolic processes, like maybe they respire carbon with oxygen, just like you and I do, or maybe they live in anoxic oxygen-free conditions, and maybe they turn organic carbon into methane. Both of those processes are pretty highly temperature-sensitive. And so if you warm the world up, you get more carbon respired or turned into methane, both of which things are amplifying feedbacks on climate change. But what we don't know as well as we should is whether, if you warm the world up and give it a bit of time, will the microbial community change, and change in a way where those responses aren't the same, basically. Some experiments have shown, this is experiments where deliberate warming of soils, for example, is done. Some of those experiments have shown that if you give it enough time, in biologist language, the microbial community changes or acclimates to the changed climate, and maybe the rates of those carbon release processes come back down again, which would be good news if it was more widely true.
So your master list of feedbacks includes seven that are negative or damping, as you say, and these should cool the planet or at least slow down warming. Could those factors also amplify enough to compete with human-induced warming?
Not as far as any of our models would suggest. In fact, there's more of a worry that the damping feedbacks, especially in the carbon cycle, so what are called the land and ocean carbon sinks, if anything, are going to get sort of proportionally weaker than they have been due to the climate change. Then there are these physical damping feedbacks, but they're kind of governed by the laws of physics, certainly in the case of the one that we hardly ever think about, which is any warm body in the universe, if you make it warmer, it gives off more radiation, or if you cool it down, it gives off less radiation. Well, that's like a famous physical kind of law almost, but it's not about to change, and we know exactly how that relationship works. Where things are quite uncertain and important is in how do clouds respond to climate change. Some cloud feedbacks can damp climate change, others could amplify it, and it's just an area, a massive area of work to still try to get to the bottom of the different cloud feedbacks and how they might change in the changing climate. Recently, there's been some progress on that, using like satellite measurements to get a better handle on, for example, whether clouds over the Great Southern Ocean are full of ice crystals or not, That turns out to really matter for the resulting climate feedback, because when we warm the world up, if your clouds are full of ice crystals that melt into little water droplets, that's actually quite a good damping feedback. It turns out the clouds get more reflective if you turn the ice into water. But the measurements told us that, oh, actually those clouds have got a lot less ice in them than we thought they did. And that means when you warm the world up, you can quite rapidly max out or switch off that feedback and stop its damping effects. That turns out to be really important, because unfortunately that means without that damping feedback, you suddenly get much more global warming for any given change in greenhouse gas levels.
In 2018, two of your co-authors published a classic paper, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. In that paper, Figure 2 showed a possible shelf called Stabilized Earth, much safer than warming all the way to hothouse Earth. And since then, humans have only increased greenhouse gas emissions, even more this year, cresting at 3.5 parts per million added. Given the 27 positive feedback loops with many tipping points nearby in time, do you think an alternative to hothouse Earth is still possible?
I do think so, thankfully. And I was an author on that 2018 paper. It's still possible. There are probably other Earths that we weren't drawn on the diagram as well that are possible. I would call one of them the wet house Earth, where we've lost major ice sheets, the sea levels are much higher, and the continental coastlines are redrawn. But yeah, luckily we're still in a situation where there is overall quite a lot of amplifying feedback in the system, but not enough to send us over the metaphorical cliff edge into hothouse Earth. Basically, we're in a situation where with no feedbacks at all, except for the sort of fundamental laws of physics, if we doubled the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, we would have expected about 1.2 degrees centigrade of warming. Whereas including the feedbacks we know about, we expect that number to be more like 3 degrees centigrade on the century timescale and could be as much as 6 degrees centigrade on the long millennial timescale. So that's saying that there is a lot of overall amplification in the climate system, but crucially it's not at the point where it will go into runaway and just be self-propelling warming, which is the hothouse Earth scenario. We still need to really work out how plausible and how much extra push it needs to get to hothouse Earth. But the crucial thing is, if you have a system that's already quite a strong amplifier and there's some feedback you missed that is just a little bit of extra amplification, well, it adds disproportionately onto what you already have. And people who do electrical engineering and make circuits and actual real amplifiers know this quite well. So that's the crucial stuff we're trying to get to the bottom of, and hopefully this paper helps a little bit.
In 2017, the IPCC said average global warming reached 1 degree C, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, over pre-industrial. They predicted 1.5 degrees C of warming by 2040. Now, to me, that seems out the window. What do you think?
Well, I think we are going to hit 1.5 degrees C warming. When we're going to hit it, well, we could have a year soon, certainly in the 2030s, where we hit it temporarily, and the average will be going through 1.5 degrees C sometime in the 2030s or 2040s. But there's still a lot to play for, because from my own studies of damaging climate tipping points, we know that several are at risk, but those risks go up disproportionately more for each 0.1 degrees C of warming. And the same would be true for other kinds of climate damages and impacts. So every 0.1 of a degree C counts as a simple message, I guess, even though it looks sadly like we're definitely going to transgress that 1.5 degree C target. And unfortunately, current policies, such as they are still taking us into a world that's going to be at least 2.5 degrees C warmer in the second half of this century. And depending on these feedbacks, could be quite a bit warmer than that.
You know, in this whole important paper, I only found one sentence where I strongly disagree. You and your co-authors write, quote, "The accuracy of climate models is of vital importance since they guide climate mitigation efforts. by informing policymakers about the expected effects of anthropogenic emissions, end quote. But really, policymakers are not mitigating anything about emissions. We're just expanding into the natural world. It's all increasing. Do you think academics are over-optimistic about the role of science in this whole policy thing?
Well, we do have a propensity to be over-optimistic, and we like to believe that we live in a world of evidence-based policymaking. But I spend a bit of time with some great policymakers, and even they acknowledge that there's quite a lot of policy-based evidence-making, as they call it. So, and we're not all naive about the situation. On the plus side, there are some bold policies that might be presented as due to other reasons, but here I'm thinking of things like the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, that are actually quite bold moves to incentivize and accelerate the transition to renewable energy, electrified transport, and all the rest, which isn't the whole solution. But from my own analysis, it's clear we need strong policies to greatly accelerate our efforts to decarbonize the economy and to kind of switch from destroying forests and land use being a source of greenhouse gases to, you know, working with the land and ecosystems to hopefully help them take up greenhouse gases. There's some policies that are really appearing now that are going to help that. We need more, but I'm not without some sense of realistic hope, I guess, whilst also realising that often the science isn't really getting a full look in.
Tim Lenton, back to the science. What is the difference between feedback loops and tipping points, and do they interact?
So a tipping point is a particular kind of phenomenon that can happen when a reinforcing feedback loop within a system gets really strong, gets so strong that if we think about it abstractly, if you put one unit of change into the system initially, it goes around the feedback loop once and gives you additional units of change, which can then go around again and give you another unit and another unit. That's a kind of runaway situation. Most reinforcing feedback loops are not that strong. You put one unit of change in, you might get back 0.1 units of change. You go around again, you get 0.01 units of change, and so on, and that converges. So tipping points are like a special case of really strong reinforcing feedback, and that's how it's differentiated from this general picture of trying to understand both damping and reinforcing feedbacks of all kinds of strength. Also, this paper we're talking about is trying to look at the feedback on global temperature, basically. So feedback's explicitly at the global level. When I talk about a tipping point in a part of the climate system, the crucial strong reinforcing feedback that can bring about a tipping point is within that system, not necessarily to the whole global temperature. So what I mean is, like, within the Greenland ice sheet system, if you warm the Greenland ice sheet up, the surface drops in altitude, that puts into warmer air, which warms things up further, and that feedback can get strong enough to go into runaway. But it's not necessarily a strong feedback to the global temperature or the global situation. Those are the key distinctions, but clearly they're related. And some tipping points, like the possibility of abrupt thawing of the permafrost, which is kind of related to a feedback whereby there's heat gets released within the system that thaws more permafrost and so on. Well, that one is quite important for the other reason that it is also an important feedback to global warming. Not a runaway feedback to global warming, thankfully, but quite a significant amplifier. And that's super important, but not all. Some tipping points also have that amplifying feedback to global warming. Another one would be the tipping point for the Amazon rainforest would release a lot of carbon, as would a tipping point for boreal forests. Then there are other tipping points, like Toulouse coral reefs in the tropics on a large scale, that would be a disaster for lots of reasons, but would not have a strong feedback, not an amplifying one anyway, to global climate.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Tim Lenton from the University of Exeter, and we're talking about new science warning feedback loops could destabilize climate much sooner than we thought. Scientists Kevin Trenberth and Michael Mann suggest buffering by the global ocean is powerful enough to contain further warming, including feedback effects, once humans stop adding more greenhouse gases. Do you agree, or could a combination of feedbacks overpower even ocean buffering?
Well, what we know is that the ocean is doing a couple of important things. It's taking up carbon dioxide, so that's what we call the ocean carbon sink. And, yeah, it's taking up heat, and it's expanding because of that, and that's a key part of the global warming itself. And what our models suggest, interestingly, it varies from model to model, but if we could stop all the greenhouse gas emissions, the removal of carbon by the ocean, the sink, would gradually fall away because the sink is driven basically by the emissions, putting stuff into the atmosphere that then wants to react with the ocean. And as for the heat uptake of the ocean, well, most models would predict you would still have a time where you continue to take up heat in the ocean, because what the whole climate or planet is trying to do is find what we call energy balance. And we're in a situation where we're out of energy balance and there's more heat being trapped in the climate than can escape. And to balance things up, the ocean needs to warm up such that it will radiate more heat back out to space, basically. So that actually carries on for quite a while, even if you shut off the emissions. And there's a kind of competition between the fact that you'd expect the CO2 and greenhouse gas level in the atmosphere to be declining, but the ocean heat uptake might still be increasing. In some models, those two things kind of cancel out and you get a temperature flatline. In some models, you get a small cooling, but kind of like the declining greenhouse gases kind of wins. In other models, it carries on warming because still the ocean heat uptake and adjustment wins. Overall, best guess, which is sort of, if you stop the emissions, you just get roughly a stable temperature for quite a long time. But we could go either way is the sort of the honest answer.
Some of the most radical projections out there on the net about warming, especially in the near term, build on the idea that we can add expected warming from each feedback mechanism to reach a scary total, like simple math. Other scientists caution it's not that simple. There's both positive warming and negative cooling feedbacks working around. What do you think?
Well, I'm with the it's not that simple, but what I would emphasize is our best assessment is we're in a situation of overall amplifying feedback, but it's constrained. It's not going to cause runaway, thankfully, runaway global climate change. But the big question is, how much is the overall amplification? So that's why we build these sophisticated climate models and compare different models to see if we can get a consistent picture. And we still have quite a lot of uncertainty over what climate scientists call climate sensitivity, which is kind of a simple way of expressing how much is this overall amplification, because it just tries to describe how much warmer will the world get if you double the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere. And try as we might, for decades, we've been trying to narrow that thing down and get a best guess on it, and it still has a fair uncertainty range on it. And our best guess sometimes goes up and sometimes comes back down again. And what we've seen in the last decade is these new observations that I mentioned of those ice crystals and clouds over the southern ocean. Well, that, when it was used to inform the models, it suddenly tended to make the climate sensitivity higher in the models. So sometimes maybe we discover something new and improve the models and it goes the other way. But unfortunately, we're still living with that uncertainty. And we can constrain the lower limit on climate sensitivity with observations because, you know, we've seen a certain amount of warming, so the climate sensitivity can't be below the level that's needed to explain the warming we've seen, but it's harder to constrain the upper limit, and that's what we continue to work on.
So, Tim, do you and your colleagues think it's possible that warming, instead of climbing gradually, could jump up a step, arriving as surprising heat, not just as a series of events, but as a new state?
I sincerely hope that won't happen. I would just say that I'd like to be able to rule that out, but we can't rule it out. It's still what I'd call a possible scenario. Perhaps a scientist like me's task is to try to rule that out, and if they can't rule it out, then they have to keep highlighting it and encourage others to work on it. But in essence, for there to be that kind of global tipping point to a different climate state, the reinforcing feedbacks would need to be a little bit more and a little bit stronger than the models currently have them. And that's why this recent paper could be relevant, because it highlights a few reinforcing feedbacks that may not be being modeled as much or as well as they should be. Equally, one could argue we might have missed some damping feedbacks that could bring things back the other way. So it's just in a risk assessment spirit that one has to say, well, if I can't rule out that really catastrophic outcome, I need to consider it and keep thinking about it and try to avoid it if it's possible.
From what I'm hearing from you, given our undeniable gains in climate knowledge, it sounds like we're still, as a civilization, rather stumbling around in the dark as we try to guess the amount and timing of climate disaster. Is that fair?
I sometimes feel like the blind man stumbling around looking for the keys, maybe, that they've dropped. I'd probably, be honest, say it's not that bad. There's plenty of core aspects of the basics of climate change that are kind of 19th century physics and are well tied down. The problem, as you highlight, Alex, is definitely in these non-linear changes, tipping points, possibilities of strong feedback. That's where we need to keep working. And somewhat ironically, it feels like, as a whole, the climate community has not spent as much effort trying to tie those things down as it might have spent just trying to establish, you know, the most likely climate response. And I think there are lots of reasons historically why the focus was on trying to work out the most likely outcome, partly because we were in a very defensive mode as a community under continual attack from climate skeptics and deniers and vested interests and you name it. But now, hopefully, we've got past that. And now, if we want to give the rest of society a really good risk assessment, we need to look at the possibly less likely or more uncertain, but really high-impact outcomes and try to understand those and constrain those better.
And quickly, could you give us an example of one of the 15 human feedbacks that you found that could disrupt the climate?
I'm not even sure if this would have been one that we put in this particular paper, but it's one I remember from a study that inspired me that was published way back in the late 80s or early 1990s. Even then, Dan Lashoff, he spotted that, and this isn't good news, but he spotted that the warming of the Arctic was going to open up possible fossil fuel reserves in the Arctic that might then get exploited, which would add to the greenhouse gas emissions and add to the warming and the Arctic melting. That was quite a prescient forecast in 89 or 91 when he first published it, because unfortunately since then we have seen some global powers seeking to do just that.
So you're a scientist, you're not officially activist, yet this new paper concludes we need transformative change to almost every aspect of human life, starting with the energy industry, but going on to population policies, education, and equality. It's a huge order. Why now? Why the urgency?
Well, because we feel like we're staring down the barrel of a climate gun. I think if you're someone like me and you see the evidence, well, partly the evidence that we could be at or very close to several big tipping points, but also evidence like the extraordinary climate extremes we've all witnessed on the television and some people have suffered directly in recent years. There can't be too many listeners not acknowledging that, wow, the climate is surprising us in a bad way with things we weren't expecting. So for me, I feel there's something constructive I can offer in the solution space, because the same tipping point thinking that we apply to the risks in the climate can also be applied to solving the climate crisis, because we know there are strong reinforcing feedbacks in the expansion of new technologies like renewable energy, electrified transport, and so on. And once we become aware of that, we can even begin to say, well, which policies and actions